time for us to begin this evening's proceedings. We are, as you'll all realize, delighted to have André Schleifer deliver this year's Robbins Lectures, but since he has been introduced twice already, I am going to save André's time for questions at the end of this talk and let him begin right away.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you who have persevered and are still here on the third day of these lectures. So what I'll talk about today is the application of the... Wait a minute, what happened to the computer? There we go. The application of the kinds of ideas that I've been talking about in the last two lectures to the subject of finance and corporate governance. And in particular, I'll try to understand whether the differences between legal traditions and legal origins and the interpretation of these differences that I've tried to suggest over the last 2 days, over the past 2 days, actually helps us understand financial markets. So let me start out with some background. I think that over the last 10 or 15 years, finance, the field of academic finance, has converged on kind of a unified view of corporate governance and theoretical perspective on corporate governance. And that is that fundamentally the central problem of corporate governance is the control of self-dealing or tunneling by the insiders. That is to say that throughout the world there are people who control firms, and that these people try to divert the resources of these firms to their own use. Now, examples of tunneling are many, and tunneling takes a variety of forms. It takes the form of transfer pricing and asset sales, that is to say transactions at unfair prices between different firms that the same controlling party might control, the same controlling shareholder might control. It takes the form of targeted issues and repurchases of securities, whereby corporate insiders repurchase securities from themselves at excessively high prices, or from minority shareholders at low prices, or issue securities to themselves at extremely low prices, as we see repeatedly in developing countries. When it comes to rich economies, when people talk about tunneling, they talk about consumption of perquisites such as airplanes and luxury office buildings, as well as, more recently, executive compensation. But when we talk about developing countries, tunneling can take a much broader range of forms, including outright theft. Now, the principal goal of corporate governance, then, is to restrict this kind of tunneling or self-dealing by corporate insiders. Why is that the principal goal? It's a principal goal because it is only if tunneling is restricted that investors and firms, whether they're creditors or shareholders, can get something back in return for their money, and therefore for the possibility of external finance to exist, for people to finance firms, they must have some assurance that they'll get some of their money back, or even a return on their investment, and for that, tunneling must be controlled. Now, people have proposed a variety of solutions to this problem of controlling tunneling, ranging from reputations to administrative solutions, and I'll discuss some of them later in this lecture. But I think, again, there is fairly wide agreement that the principal solution to the corporate governance problem is the law, and the law, specifically the law protecting outside investors. That is to say that investors are willing to finance firms, whether by giving them equity funds or by lending them money, if the law actually enables them to force the firm to give them some money back, to repay the loan, or to vote in the case of the shareholders, and through their voting decisions or through their powers as creditors to stop self-dealing and to force the return of some of the funds. Now, how does this connect to the kinds of things that I've been talking about in the past two lectures? Well, the basic theory that I'll try to convince you of is that common law, as an empirical matter, tends to protect investors better by shaping the contracting environment in a way that allows more effective private control of tunneling. And notice that I'm emphasizing private control of tunneling, that is to say, the shareholder and the creditor rights of action. In contrast, code countries, in particular French civil law countries, put relatively more weight on government regulation and even government ownership as a way of controlling firms or controlling managerial behavior, which I will argue is not as effective in supporting market development. So what I'll try to do is basically follow the same structure as I did yesterday, which is first present a variety of evidence trying to illustrate to you the relationship between legal origin, investor protection, and various outcomes measuring the development of financial markets, and then try to pull it together and maybe have a somewhat broader conclusion. So let me go back to the picture that I've started with yesterday, and today I'll talk about the bottom half of this picture, which is a look at company law, securities law, and the protection of outside shareholders implicit in these laws, how this protection is dependent or related to the legal origin of a country. And then I'll look at a broad range of stock market outcomes, including measures of stock market development, of valuation of publicly traded firms, of ownership structure, but as well as several other measures of financial development, and try to convince you that investor protection through company and securities law seems to be associated with better financial performance. I will then look at the credit markets and bankruptcy law in particular, and suggest that, in fact, there are systematic differences among legal origins in creditor rights and in protection of outside lenders, and I'll show that that is associated in the development of private credit markets. And finally, if you recall the picture that I put up yesterday, I've argued that one of the more extreme form of administrative solutions to the problems of social control is public ownership, and I'll present you with some data on government ownership of banks, again suggesting that it's intimately connected to legal origin and that it also bears on some of the interesting outcomes. So here is the data. First, here is some evidence on an index of shareholder rights. And this is an index that's been constructed almost 10 years ago by Florencio, Rafael, Rob Vishny, and myself for 49 countries around the world. Those are all the countries that at that time had stock markets with more than five publicly traded firms. And what we did is to construct an index. Basically, at that time, roughly speaking, we knew nothing about these issues. So we looked at six dimensions of shareholder right protection that seemed plausible to us. So the index was formed by adding one when a country allowed shareholders to mail their proxy to vote, voting proxy to the firm. Some countries allowed shareholders voting by mail, which made it easy. Other countries demanded that shareholders actually show up to the shareholders' meeting to vote, which we viewed as weaker shareholder rights. Second, if shareholders are not required to deposit their shares prior to the general shareholder meeting, some countries freeze the shares during the meeting, which makes it difficult for shareholders to retrade and to consolidate voting blocks to vote against the management. 3, whether cumulative voting or proportional representation of minorities on the board of directors is allowed, again, something that gives minorities greater power. 4, very importantly, this is probably the crucial variable, whether an oppressed minorities mechanism is in place, that is to say, whether minority shareholders have any rights, such as the right of appeal or the right of having their shares repurchased by the company when they feel abused by the majority. 5, the minimum percentage of share capital that entitles the shareholders to call an extraordinary shareholder meeting. If that percentage is less than 10%, it varies from 2 or 3% in some countries to something like 33% in a country like Mexico. And again, the lower is the block you need to assemble to call an extraordinary shareholder meeting, the more powerful the shareholders, the minority shareholders will be. And 6, whether shareholders have preemptive rights that can only be waived by shareholders' vote. And again, that's a particular guarantee against controlling shareholders issuing shares to themselves at below market prices, a practice that has been pervasive in developing countries and several transition economies. So we constructed this index. I'm not saying it's the best index that one could construct of shareholder rights, but that's what we did when we started this work. And what we have discovered is that there were sharp differences in these indices of shareholder rights among legal origins. And in particular, common law countries had almost twice as high a value of the shareholder rights index than the French legal origin countries, and then the German legal origin countries, with Scandinavian origin countries being in between. These differences are very statistically significant and, again, provide some indication that through these rights, statutory rights in corporate law, common law countries protect shareholders better. We've since looked at another aspect of shareholder protection, one that I think is conceptually and theoretically is much better justified than the index of shareholder rights, which is the index of investor rights through securities laws. And we looked at securities laws in one particular perspective, which I've discussed yesterday, that is to say the promoter's problem. That is to say, suppose that a firm issues securities, there is some news about the firm after it issues securities that are bad, the people who bought securities are unhappy, they want to sue. What are their rights? And their rights are basically dependent on two conceptual issues. One is, what is mandatory disclosure of information in the law, that is to say in the securities law, how much is the firm compelled to disclose? And that's the index that I'll talk about now. And second is that suppose the firm failed to disclose what it was mandated to disclose, in particular failed to disclose what the general umbrella rule says is material information, who has the burden of proof in showing that the firm has done something bad? Is it the outside shareholders or the management? And I'll come to the burden of proof in a minute. Let me talk about disclosure. So the index that we look at here is basically consists of 6 components. One is whether potential investors are delivered a prospectus before they can buy securities, whether compensation, the structure of major shareholdings, insider ownership, irregular contracts, which is basically contracts reflecting deals between the corporation issuing securities and other firms or businesses affiliated with the same controlling shareholders, need to be disclosed to potential buyers of securities, and whether various transactions need to be disclosed. So it's basically a measure consisting of the delivery of the prospectus and five aspects of what needs to be disclosed in these prospectuses. Now, it turns out there is enormous variation among countries in these indices, but you also find when you all add it all up that common law countries have sharply higher mandatory disclosures than French legal origin countries, and also higher disclosure requirements than German legal origins and Scandinavian legal origin countries. So the evidence here is again quite striking for the same 49 countries as the evidence on shareholder rights from corporate law. The other aspect that we've collected the data on from securities law is the liability standard. And basically there are three kinds of liability standards out there. One is something which is close to gross negligence, which is to say that unless the shareholders can prove that the distributor or the issuer or the accountants were drunk at the time when they wrote up the information, the prospectus, nobody is liable. At the other extreme, there is strict liability, which is something that exists, for example, in the United States, which is to say that the burden of proof, if some information was omitted from the prospectus, the burden of proof is entirely on the management or on the insiders to show that they couldn't have possibly known this information and revealed it. And the presumption is that is entirely that if information comes out, that the issuers and the underwriters are liable. And then in the middle, there is the negligence standard, which is some kind of a calculation on whether or not it was reasonable to presume on some kind of an economic calculation that the information could have been obtained and disclosed to the outside investors. And so we look at these liability standards separately for corporate directors, distributors, that is to say underwriters or investment banks, and accountants, because often it is the case that if you have an extreme version of the promoter's problem, a company issues securities, some terrible news comes out, if the shareholders want to sue, there is no money left in the company to sue, so the shareholders, if they want to get anything back, must sue the distributors or the accountants. And so we look at these liability standards for different parties and average among them. So you find exactly the same picture as before, which is to say that there are the highest liability standards in the common law countries, the lowest in the French legal origin and German legal origin countries, and somewhere in the middle for Scandinavian origin countries. So the same patterns seem to be there in looking at liability standards as well. And I should say that these last two variables, I really believe they are what matters. They capture what matters in this kind of shareholder litigation, which if you look at case law, if you look at litigation both in common and civil law countries, they get at the heart of what describes the legal rights of outside investors. Now, going forward to creditor rights, we've constructed an index which was recently updated for a much larger sample of countries of the rights of senior secured creditors in reorganization, and there were basically four rights that we looked at, and again this measure could be criticized. First is whether there are restrictions such as creditor consent for a debtor to file for reorganization. There are countries like the United States where a firm can seek Chapter 11 protection from creditors without creditor consent, and therefore creditors are very weak. There are other countries in which creditor consent is required before a firm can seek Chapter 11 protection. Whether there is an automatic stay on assets, that is to say, if there is no automatic stay, creditors can come in and pull collateral if they're secured creditors. If there is automatic stay, they cannot. Three, where the secured creditors are paid first out of the proceeds of liquidating a bankrupt firms. In some countries, secured creditors have the highest priority. In other countries, workers and the government come in first, which of course undermines creditor rights. And finally, whether the management does not retain administration of property pending the resolution of reorganization, that is to say, whether or not management gets to run the firm in Chapter 11 proceedings or whether it has to leave and control is ceded to an administrator or someone like that. By the way, I should say that on creditor rights, the United States is extremely weak. So this somewhat undermines the claim that this is just a pro-American construction of an index. Well, you see here a similar pattern as before, but with an important difference, which in fact reflects something that people have recognized before us, that is to say that the common law country have sharply higher measures of protection of creditor rights than French legal origin countries. But perhaps not surprisingly, German legal origin countries, which tend to be the bank-centered financial systems, also have very high, even higher, credit right protection scores. Scandinavian countries in the middle, and socialist origin countries, largely because of transition economies that have, in fact, very recently revised their bankruptcy laws and have given a great deal of powers to the creditors, also have an average, on average, relatively high value of the index. And finally, this is a measure of government ownership of banks, and this is the share of the assets of the top 10 banks in a given country owned by the government in that country in 1995, and you see this variable is 28% in common law countries, 45% in French legal origin countries, 34% in German origin countries, 35% in Scandinavian countries, and not surprisingly, the huge 62% in socialist origin countries. But there, of course, the variable was going down as banks were getting privatized. But again, we see sharp differences in the emphasis on the administrative between the common law and the French legal origin countries. Now, does this have an effect on outcomes? I'm going to look at a number of outcome variables, and I'll just go through them quickly, which is we'll look at the most standard one, which is the ratio of market cap to GNP. We'll look at a logarithm of the number of domestic firms listed on a stock exchange, which is a measure of the breadth of the stock market. We'll look at some measure of the intensity of IPO activity relative to GDP. We'll look at the block premium, which several people have regarded as a good measure of insecurity of property rights of minority shareholders, that is to say the difference in the price of voting shares and non-voting shares. We'll look at ownership concentration, which is a measure of whether there is, in fact, a possibility of dispersed ownership. And then for creditor rights, we will look at the private credit to GDP ratio and the interest rate spread. So here are some of the results. And so there is a very sharp and strong relationship between our measure of shareholder rights and the market cap to GDP ratio. Likewise, for the number of listed firms, and I'll go through these very quickly. Likewise, for the ratio of the value of annual value of IPO activities to GDP, there is a reverse relationship, as would be predicted by the theory, between shareholder rights and block premium. There is also a negative relationship between shareholder rights index and our measures of ownership concentration, that is to say that ownership dispersion seems to be a consequence of strong legal protection of outside shareholders. Now, if you look at disclosure, the results, in fact, are much, much stronger for the shareholder rights index. The stronger the disclosure requirements, the higher is the market cap to GDP. The stronger the disclosure requirements, the more listed firms are. These are, by the way, cross-sectional regressions. So, you know, these results are not supposed to be that strong. IPO value, block premium, ownership concentration. If you look at the burden of proof, liability standards predict high market capitalization, number of listed firms, IPO value, block premium, ownership concentration. Now, if you run a horse race, I should mention, between the securities law variables, which is to say liability standards and disclosure index, they work, they destroy the statistical significance of shareholder rights, which is to say these more recently constructed and more better economically justified disclosure and liability standards variable have much better predictive power than the corporate law variables we constructed 10 years ago. Now, for private credit, the results are not as strong, but they're also quite statistically significant, which is to say that countries with stronger creditor rights have the higher ratio of private credit to GDP. And there is somewhat weaker evidence that government ownership of banks is associated with a higher spread between the lending rate and the borrowing rate, which is, that is to say, the rate at which the banks lend and the rate at which they pay their depositors, which many people regard as a measure of efficiency of government banks. So those are the fundamental results. What can one say about their robustness, first of all, and their interpretation? First, the same two questions as I've raised yesterday. Is it politics? That is to say, if we take the measures of limited government to measures of left-wing politics, do they predict the indices of shareholder and credit rights and government ownership of banks? The answer is yes, politics is very important for government ownership of banks, not surprisingly, although it does not kill the effect of legal origin. But on the other hand, there seems to be very little relationship, if any, between political variables and any other indicator of shareholder and creditor rights. So it's not politics. Is it culture? So again, we looked at percentage of people in various religions and percent Protestant as predictors of shareholder and creditor rights. And again, the answer is it is not culture. It is legal origin. So let me discuss some of the issues about the interpretation of the robustness of these findings before I go into more general problems. I'm raising these issues not necessarily because I think they're so fascinating for a general interest audience, but because they've been fairly heavily debated and discussed. So the first question is, does the anti-director rights index that I've presented to you, Is it the right indicator of shareholder rights? Do other aspects of corporate law matter? I think my view today is that almost surely the indicators are not the best ones. The index was always, even in the 1998 paper, supposed to capture the stance of the law rather than the exact legal rights that are central. Other aspects of corporate law addressing self-dealing might be as or more important, and securities laws appear to be, at least empirically, much more important than the measures of shareholder rights that we described in that paper. But it's also the case that such issues as fiduciary standards in common law countries, which seem to be absent in civil law, might be important. In addition, approval rules related to self-dealing transactions might be very important. In fact, our current research seems to identify enormous differences among common and civil law countries in their tolerance and in their approval procedures for proposed self-dealing transactions by corporate insiders. That is to say that in common law countries, it's generally the case that these transactions are intensely disliked by courts and must be approved by the general shareholder meetings, whereas in civil law countries, these transactions are not nearly as badly looked upon by courts, and in fact, the approval procedures required by law for self-dealing transactions are much less burdensome for the corporate insiders who propose them. Second, are the anti-director rights and creditor rights indices permanent? This has been an issue that has been heavily debated. And I think it's very clear now that there is some indication that these indices do change over time. For example, Franks, Mayer, and Rossi find substantial improvement in the anti-director rights index in the United Kingdom over the last 100 years. On the other hand, in the paper on creditor rights that I've discussed with you, we found no change in creditor right indices and no convergence across legal origins between 1978 and 2003. Would I take the position that the law is the only thing that can protect investors? This is another issue that has created a great deal of controversy. I think the answer is no, absolutely not. There is, for example, a role for bubbles, that is to say, countries seem to go through a period of extremely high stock market valuations that lead to significant issuance of securities, even in the regime of very poor investor protection. There is room for reputations, and I think the role for underwriters. And there is room for other sanctions. For example, social sanctions appear to restrict self-dealing in Scandinavian countries, as a number of authors who write about Sweden and Denmark have indicated. Recent research by Katerina Pistor and Chenggang Zhu also suggests that administrative sanctions against self-dealing appear to restrict tunneling in China. So there are substitutes for law, but having said that, it appears to be the case that most societies appear to recognize eventually the ultimate importance of law as the mechanism of controlling tunneling. And of course, if you look at the data, you find this extremely strong association between legal rules, which seem to be driven largely by legal origin, and a range of outcomes measuring the development of financial markets. Now, another important question is, does the law necessarily come from legislature? Again, the answer to that is no. It can come from self-governing organizations such as stock exchanges. In fact, many countries have delegated the writing of their securities regulations to their stock exchanges. So the emphasis here is on the need of investor protection through the legal system or through regulation of various activities, not on the source of the law and whether the law comes from legislature, from stock exchanges. Now, how do we interpret these results, and how do they fit into the basic story? Well, here we appear to have a bit of an intellectual challenge to the basic theory. It appears that common law, if anything, is more regulating with respect to financial transactions and with respect to tunneling. There is greater regulation of the relationship between controlling shareholders and minority shareholders in the common law countries, as we see in the indices of shareholder rights, and there are also considerably greater regulation of disclosure requirements. So I've been trying to persuade you that common law countries are less regulatory, and see here it appears to be the opposite. But I don't think there is really as much of a conflict for the following reason. I don't think it's correct to say that the regulations in common law countries of the transactions, of corporate transactions, are really administrative solutions to the problems of tunneling. Most of the common law regulations of corporate governments appear to be rules facilitating private action and private enforcement. There is no greater utilization of administrative enforcement. In fact, we have collected data on the intensity of public enforcement of securities laws, and our intuition from the U.S. notwithstanding, there does not appear to be significant differences between common law and civil law countries in the intensity of public enforcement of securities laws. And there is, seems to be, more importantly, no relationship between the intensity of public enforcement and the development of securities markets. So the kinds of rights that common law countries seem to guarantee minority shareholders are those that really facilitate private action. They are those that enable minority shareholders to vote, to oust management, and to sue, and more importantly, win the lawsuits more easily. Greater disclosure requirements and lighter burden of proof seem to facilitate private action against promoters and corporate insiders. Law and legislation are used to support private action, at least in the domain of financial markets. Rules are not set to support public solutions or administrative solutions. In contrast, in civil law countries, there appears to be more emphasis on administrative solutions, including even government ownership of banks, and such solutions do not appear to work to foster financial development. Thus, there seems to be more consistency with other patterns of social control that appears to, at first glance, that is to say, common law seems to stand for facilitation of public of private solutions, even if such facilitation requires a public framework, whereas civil law, particularly French civil law, seems to stand for the emphasis on administrative solutions. So I think that this tension that I've just described can be successfully resolved, and that finance presents further evidence of regulatory styles consistent with the general approach. Okay, that's what I have to say about finance. Let me now try, in conclusion, to spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes to return to some of the general themes, or some of the general questions that are raised by this work. Now, some people have interpreted this work by saying that legal origin is destiny, and therefore civil law countries are destined to have poor financial markets and heavy-handed government, whereas common law countries are destined to have success or differences in these areas. I don't think we interpret our evidence this way. I think that common law has a great deal of explanatory power, but I don't think we've ever tried to suggest that history is destiny. That is to say, there are many examples of successful legal reforms. There are many examples of administrative reforms in the context of common law countries. And there are perhaps fewer, but there are some examples of deregulation and private solution-based reforms in civil law countries. For example, France, I think, ironically, has been one of the leading civil, if not the leading civil law countries, in trying to find non-administrative solutions to some of the social problems. Now, having said that, I think it's incredibly important to recognize, and this is one of the main lessons of this work, is that whatever solution is proposed has to be generally consistent with the basic legal infrastructure and the basic principles of the legal system of a country. So one example of that that I want to suggest to you, for example, is that common law countries, in the case of financial markets, have some history of introduction and successful enforcement of insider trading laws. There's virtually no, these are the laws prohibiting unannounced trading by corporate insiders in the shares of their companies. Turns out that criminalization of insider trading really doesn't work very well in civil law countries because judges seem to have a great deal of trouble dealing with such issues as intent of the people involved in insider trading. That is to say that when a person comes in and said, look, I needed the money, which is why I sold the shares just before the price fell, or give some other argument, it seems that the civil law systems, particularly in developing countries, have not been able to address this kind of problem. You need more of a mechanism that is implicit in common law to deal with this. So there is a very important issue of compatibility of reform with the structure of the legal system, which we see again and again. But that is not to say that reform is never possible. The second general point that I want to make is that there is no implication in this work that common law is better at everything and that you never need administrative solution. There is a strong and plausible claim that civil law may work better when disorder is a serious problem, although I should tell you that despite significant efforts to find cross-country evidence for that proposition, we have not been able to find much. If you look within countries, it's pretty easy to find evidence that, in fact, administrative solutions in general and regulation in particular is a response to the problem of disorder. For example, Ed Glaser and I looked at the rise of regulation in the United States, a lot of which seems to have occurred at the beginning of the 20th century. And it seems very clear that the principal political driving force for the introduction of these regulations was the widely perceived power of the robber barons and the ability of the robber barons to charge monopoly prices, to bribe politicians, to bribe courts, and to basically bend the system of enforcement of social control operating through contract and tort law to their advantage. And that if you look at the speeches or writings of Roosevelt or Wilson at that period, then you will see that the problem of enforcement through courts and the ability of the robber barons to subvert the system was one of the principal political forces for justifying government regulation. So in fact, we do see many instances where the same kind of conceptual problems we've discussed lead to administrative solutions within the common law system. But I think that the kinds of things that I've talked about today and yesterday and the day before tell you about how to evaluate administrative solution and suggest that there is a more general lesson here. And in fact, that lesson or that question was raised by someone right after the first lecture I gave. And the question is, how do we think about the costs and benefits of the administrative solutions? And I think that what this analysis suggests is, again, the danger of going to the extremes. Economists seem to have two schools of thinking about regulation, you know, what I call the Stiglitz School and the Stigler School. You know, the Stiglitz School has never seen a regulation it didn't like and have never seen a market it did like. And the Stigler School, of course, is the other way around. And what this kind of perspective seems to suggest that, in fact, in thinking about the optimal form of intervention in different markets, one must recognize the essential role played by the essential trade-off between dictatorship and disorder, and the fact that this trade-off may vary depending on the administrative capabilities of a country, a country's legal system, and a country's level of development, and in particular, how much you reduce disorder by introducing the incremental level of dictatorship may play a crucial role in thinking about the form of intervention. Now, that may be a very general proposition, but it is not a content-free proposition. Let me go back to the example of securities regulation that I've discussed. So what we've done in that work is to say, to ask the question, what works in securities laws? What is the optimal form of government intervention, or government regulation of securities markets? And we've looked at the data, and we've looked at securities laws, and the data told us something. What did the data tell us? Well, it told us that laissez-faire does not work, that the countries with successful securities markets actually have a fair amount of government intervention and regulation. The data also told us that what matters for successful intervention and regulation is not administrative solutions. That is to say, it is not the big securities and exchange commissions. It's not big financial service authorities. What matters for successful regulation of securities markets is a legal framework whereby potential issuers of securities are forced to disclose extensive amounts of information to investors about the securities they're selling. And in addition to that, should they fail to do so, it must be made relatively easy for investors to recover damages. That is to say, the burden of proof must be on the issuers to show that, in fact, they couldn't have possibly known that the bad news is there or is coming. So in fact, even though the framework seems to be hopelessly general, once you start thinking about the world using this framework, and once you start measuring things using time series or experiments or a cross-section of countries, you can actually think more coherently about government intervention. The final point that I want to return to is the question about, I've been talking about unemployment and financial market development and securities markets development and debt and all this other good stuff. What about growth? And I made some comments in my first lecture about the fact that we've seen absolutely no evidence so far that there is an association between institutions and subsequent economic growth, a statement that I still subscribe to. And haven't changed my mind in the last 48 hours. But a number of people have come to see me in this temporary office I had and asking me what I've been drinking. I think this is a challenge we have, which is that I think we have, in fact, been assembled over the last decade from various sources a great deal of evidence indicating that institutions vary tremendously across countries, that these institutions matter a great deal for the particular markets that they affect. But it is still the case that, except for suggesting that perhaps some markets are very important and financial markets are somewhat important for growth, but they're not tremendously important for growth, I think that the relationship between institutions and economic growth has so far proved to be elusive, and I think one of the challenges of all this work is try to connect this ultimately to economic performance. So just to summarize, what I've tried to do in the last 3 days is to understand one small piece of the DNA of market economies. What I want to leave you with is the absolutely key role of objective measurement of institutions and their consequences for carrying out this research agenda, and a suggestion that this kind of objective measurement gives us opportunities both to think about the role of government in the economy and its consequences for various outcomes we care about, as well as about the possibilities of productive reform. Thank you very much.
Can we take some questions?
I'm happy to take some questions if there are any.
Another Chelsea game on?
Yes, please.
I wonder if you'd like to make some comments on the financial integration which is being attempted within the euro area at the moment. One of the premises on which it's based is that if we get an integrated financial market like the United States, then this will contribute to the growth rate in Europe. Well, that seems to be belied by what you've just said. But do you see this financial market integration as at least going in the right direction, or is it going to be more on the French civil model than on the British model, as I think some people in the City of London fear?
This reminds me of an old joke that a Canadian friend of mine once told me about, that the idea of Canada was that it will be a country with British politics, French culture, and American know-how, and that it ended up being a country with, let me see if I get this straight, French politics, American culture, and British know-how. That was a joke from the pre-Thatcher days. I think it's pretty clear what I think from what I've indicated, which is to say that if the legal foundation of financial, of the European financial system is going to be a civil law structure, it is not going to be conducive for financial development in Europe. And I think that all the indication that we have so far is that that is the direction in which the legal infrastructure is headed. I think it's the French way of keeping the English down. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, please, I'm sorry.
Yesterday when we were discussing the institutions possibilities frontier, we had one graph which showed that LDCs have a flatter curve, which is to say that higher government intervention would not probably have as high a social cost in developed countries as compared to the LDCs.
Yes.
Was that also a result of the regression study, or is that...
That's a very important question. The regression results differ, and I don't remember the results across markets. So in some countries, you do find that, in fact, the costs of intervention are considerably higher in developing in the poorer countries than in the richer countries. In other markets, you don't. One problem you face in implementing this kind of research is that, of course, in many developing countries, particularly the really poor countries, the regulations are not enforced and are simply ignored. And so what happens is that rather than conform to government regulation, the economy becomes, the business activity flows into the unofficial sector. And in fact, I've shown you some evidence yesterday, and there is a lot more evidence in the same spirit that suggests that one of the consequences of heavy regulation in the developing countries is the rise of the growth of the unofficial economy. But in answer to your question, I think the evidence that you've asked for, it exists, but it varies depending on the market that you look at.
And I know you've done a lot of work on corruption in the framework of this general project. I was just wondering if you, in this particular data you've been analyzing the last three lectures, it's a formalistic measurement of the laws,
yes,
as they are in the documents. And obviously, if there have got to be issues about how exactly those laws are enforced.
Yes.
And so, I mean, if I just to think of one example, obviously Italy falls in your French civil code group, but of course, irrespective of the nature of the laws, there are cases where judges are paid to make decisions they might otherwise not have made, and the current Prime Minister was involved in such a case.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering how that affects the implications of your analysis. I guess you could argue the common law countries are less likely to be corrupt and the laws are more likely to be enforced, but it is possible, isn't it, for enforcement to vary within categories, and that might affect the results.
Okay, first of all, let me talk about the empirical matter. Well, let me first start with the broad issue, which is that you're absolutely right that enforcement is extremely important. And if you take the view that the laws on the books don't matter at all, you will, and only enforcement of the laws matter, then everything I've been talking about is spurious. Having said that, I think that the way in which I interpret the data, and I've mentioned something about this yesterday, is that the extreme view that all that matters is enforcement and that the structure of, as you call them, formalistic laws is irrelevant doesn't seem to be supported by the data, which is to say that it does appear that for specific markets, the formalistic laws matter a great deal, as you've seen, for example, in the securities law study. That's the first point. Second point is that there is a relationship between legal origin and corruption. There is a new paper out there by a Swedish economist called Jacob Svensson, who in fact looked at the relationship between legal origin and corruption and has found that, I think, on 3 out of 4 databases of corruption, cross-country databases he's used, French civil law countries tend to be more corrupt than the common law countries. Now, that raises a conceptual issue, which is, you know, how do you think about it? So one way to think about corruption is to say that, look, you have these very burdensome regulations, but they don't really matter because people just pay off the judges or pay off the regulators to escape the burden of the law. Another interpretation, which to me is more plausible perhaps, is that in fact the possibility of corruption only raises the cost of complying with these regulations because in many instances people have to pay off a number of regulators and they still remain vulnerable after they pay off. I think that the fact that we see the significant effects on outcomes suggests that the possibility of corruption does not undo or eliminate the burden of administrative controls. But I agree with you at a broader level than the understanding of the relationship between corruption and the formal law is kind of the next stage, and more broadly between enforcement and the formalistic law is something that's clearly on the agenda of this kind of work. Yes, please. There's a question in the back. No? Yes.
You've cited these regressions you've run. I presume you've run into a number of econometric problems in running these regressions. It would be interesting to know what techniques you use to get around them in terms of instrument variables and things like that.
Okay. Well, I don't know which specific of the many econometric problems that I run into you have in mind. One of the things you may notice is that I did not present to you or talk about the instrumental variable regressions, despite the fact that I've made the argument that legal origin for most of the country is exogenous because of the colonial experience and so on. One of the reasons that I have not done that is because I'm very nervous about the exclusion restriction, that is to say, whether or not there may be other channels through which legal origin affects outcomes other than the specific laws that we go out and measure. Now, I should say that we are on firmer ground than some of the other work in this area in the sense that, in the very particular sense, which is to say that it stands to reason on theoretical grounds that financial markets are going to be influenced through the laws governing financial markets rather than through some other channels, and that labor markets would be influenced through labor regulations rather than through some other channels. And so maybe one could plausibly argue for the exclusion restriction, but it would not be a watertight argument. And one can do econometric tests and all this other good stuff, and I'm not sure whether they convince anybody. So I think that our solution has been to, in fact, to move away from the instrumental variable interpretations of these findings. As far as other econometric problems are concerned, those tend to be the questions of omitted variable, which is there something other than legal origin that has been driving these results? And I, as I've indicated repeatedly, is we and others have done a huge amount of work in this area. Maybe all of that work, again, is misguided because you can never measure the right kind of politics and the right kind of culture or whatever is the other idea that comes to mind. And that one of the things, if you just stare at the data and look at the simple correlations in the data, one of the things that is entirely obvious is that no matter how you measure politics or no matter how you measure culture, the explanatory power, to the extent that we have a menu of options available, the explanatory power of these variables for most of the phenomena that I've talked about is miserable compared to the explanatory power of legal origin. This is not to say that these arguments would end in the next 10 years, but I think that the data suggests that these are somewhat far-fetched arguments, at least to me. Other econometric problems, I don't know about. Yes, please.
This is the last question, I think, for this evening.
I wondered, if I'm a policymaker, what would I take away from this? So I might, I mean, I think I'm convinced in the results that you show me, but I guess it's very hard to change your legal system. And I presume in your data set, you know, virtually no or no countries do that, which is why you focus on the cross-sectional results. So in particular, you know, to take an example, if you were speaking to the French government, imagine they bought into all your results, what would you advise them to do?
Well, the French government, interestingly, has done a lot of things without my advice, which appear totally sensible in this framework, which is to say that, for example, a lot of business litigation in France has moved out of the French formal procedure and into a special separate system of courts, where business people serve the role of judges and so on. That turns out to be a much more general success story than just France, which is that if you want to think about the problems of legal formalism, and there are some justifications for them, then the solution that seems to have worked both in common law countries and particularly in civil law countries is to take simple litigation out of this basic court system and into a system of much less formal courts, which, you know, you can try to call community courts or you can try to call more common law-like courts. And that has been done successfully in a number of developing countries, both in the common law world and in the civil law world. And the idea is that you get rough justice, but simultaneously you are not burdened by many of the inefficiencies that are associated with heavy administration formalism. This is the kind of stuff that I think this directs you to. I mean, the other kind of advice, which is something that I care about deeply, is a warning against regulation requiring heavy administrative capacity in developing countries. So, for example, to take my favorite Joe Stiglitz, he's been going around suggesting for many years now that the problem of monopoly is central to transition economies and developing economies, and that they should immediately introduce anti-monopoly agencies before they possibly do any other reform to deal with the problem of monopoly. I know of no developing or transition economy in which the anti-monopoly agency has been anything but a source of corruption and business abuse. Okay. It is the worst thing you can possibly do. Okay, so again, some awareness of the kinds of issues that I'm trying to talk about, even if one does not have exact empirical details. It's better to have empirical details, but some awareness of these problems, I think, will go a long way toward somewhat more informed policy choice.
Well, that's a wonderful practical note on which to end this series of lectures, and it remains for me only to thank Andre for maintaining the high reputation of the Robbins Lectures. Thank you all.
Thank you.